I next met with Dr. Dirk Arnold to chat about colorectal cancer and particularly some of the recent exciting developments in a number of anti-angiogenic strategies. But to begin, we talked about a vexing, very common clinical situation with this disease, consideration of adjuvant treatment in stage 2 colon cancer.
We know that there is a subset of stage 2 patients which prognosis without chemotherapy is even worse than with stage 3. And on the other hand, we have patients who have a very high likelihood to be cured. The instruments we have in our hands today is clinical risk factors, so like tumor perforation and all this stuff, and it's molecular information, and molecular information coming from single markers and from complex gene arrays, which are commercially available and which also give some prognostic information. The problem we have is that all information we have is only prognostic. So we're searching for predictive markers telling us which patient might benefit from a distinct treatment. But all information in all of these disciplines, either clinically or molecularly, is only prognostic. So this is the finding as of today.
So I understand that no genomic assay right now will achieve what happened in ER-positive HER2-negative breast cancer, namely demonstrate a group with greater and lesser relative risk reduction. But if you look at the Oncotype colon paper just published in the JCO from the QUASAR data of single-agent fluoropyrimidine treatment, it appears that since the relative risk reduction with chemo in the various risk categories is about the same, that you could actually get a quantitative projective absolute benefit, although it's a pretty narrow range.
It is. I think this still holds true, meaning relative risk reduction in high-risk situation means a higher absolute risk reduction, and therefore one could reinforce the concept of treating those patients. But you're absolutely right. The relative risk reduction is the same in all prognostic groups. From Oncotype, you receive strong prognostic information. Oncotype uses clinical factors like T4, which are clearly excluded for the analysis, and uses good prognostic feature like MSI high status, which are also excluded from the benefit of this because one of them have poor prognosis defined by clinics, the other by a single marker. But for the rest of the patient, we get a quite strong information, prognostic information on the basis of Oncotype, but nothing about the relative benefit of a 5-FU treatment in these patients.
Again, trying to understand what's in the JCO. In the editorial, Dr. Benson, I think, recommends considering using Oncotype in patients who have, quote, adverse clinical pathologic factors. Is that the way you read it? And do you agree with that?
Right. I would somehow agree it because the pathological factors we learn from single markers is not as good prospectively evaluated as this complex type is like. So this might add to this, or in fact, it might substitute. So we do not know about the meaning, for example, of tumor budding or differentiation, grading, et cetera, et cetera. All of these factors are not prospectively followed up. So Oncotype gives additional information in terms of precise prediction of the patient's prognosis without treatment, but nothing, again, about the relative increment with 5-FU treatment.
So in breast cancer, you have both in the United States, the Oncotype and the MammaPrint available, yeah, utilized, and mainly the Oncotype is being used right now. It seems like something evolving like that in colon cancer with the so-called ColoPrint. What do you think about that assay?
It's another assay using less molecular markers than Oncotype does, but also uses no clinical information, purely uses the molecular information. And I think it's more or less in the same level of development like Oncotype. We get prognostic information, which is quite strong in predicting, but again, all of these markers should be evaluated prospectively in terms of prediction of benefit of distinct treatment.
In your own practice outside a trial setting, how do you approach patients with stage 2 disease, and in what situations, if any, will you treat them and with what?
Well, that's an excellent question. So by the lack of benefit being given from oxaliplatin and by the adverse events from oxaliplatin, we know. So only a very small portion of patients will be treated with an oxaliplatin-based combination, meaning patients with a very high clinical risk for recurrence. So perforation, T4 stage, et cetera, et cetera. For the rest, only 5-FU, a single agent, or capecitabine should be regarded as an option. And the first decision-making thing in most European countries, at least, is not the molecular profiling, but rather the clinical information we have from this. So clinical information, A, independent of tumor status, is the patient candidate for adjuvant treatment? What about the spontaneous prognosis? What about comorbidity, et cetera, et cetera? And B, what clinical information do we obtain from the situation? Meaning how many lymph nodes have been examined, how does the grading, et cetera, look like? And given all this information, we make a distinct point of information from that. Once the patient is at a certain intermediate risk, meaning having a good differentiated tumor, like more than 15 lymph nodes assessed, we would individually consider this patient to be treated with 5-FU and go to the patient, speak to the patient and the relatives and tell them that the absolute benefit of a 5-FU-based treatment in this situation will be between 3 and 7%, not more, not less. If you would like to know whether it's 3% or 7%, molecular information could give you additional hint, but you can limit it to the range of 3 to 7 or 3 to 8% of absolute gain by just using clinical information you have from the patient.
So if you could access it, and I don't know if you can access it in that situation, would you use any of these genomic tests, for example, in that situation?
So only if the patient wants to know whether his risk is at 3% or at 7%, like this. This is the only information we get from this.
And which tests would you use?
Well, actually, to make things even more complicated, we have a different one, which is called Predictor C. And this one is now presented at this ASCO GI meeting, the second analysis of this. And so for scientific purpose, we use this, and otherwise we use either Oncotype DX or Coloprint, but mostly Oncotype DX in this.
And if you're going to use a fluoropyrimidine, how do you decide between 5-FU and capecitabine?
Well, most patients, I think if there are no contraindications, we rather use capecitabine in this situation.
How do patients usually respond to this? And do you think this information, and do you see a difference in the younger, healthier patient compared to the older patients and how they respond to these numbers and these options?
Well, actually, of course, younger patients have a higher interest in doing everything which could help in their situation to be cured. So the acceptance of 5-FU-based treatment is higher in these patient group, of course. But on the other hand, one might think that younger patients should also be treated with oxaliplatin because this might add some extra benefit in this. But on the other hand, given the long-term toxicity of oxaliplatin, there's also a contraindication by a patient being at a younger age because if neuropathy occurs, it will be challenged lifelong.
So I want to move in a minute towards new agents, metastatic disease, the kinds of things that oncologists really want to hear about and where a lot of things are happening. But just to kind of finish up in terms of earlier disease, how do you approach neoadjuvant chemoradiation therapy of rectal cancer at this point?
That's an interesting approach. So considering the good imaging we have in most situations with MRI-defined resection margins and the circumferential resection margin definition given from the Mercury trial and from all these trials, I think quite a lot of patients are overtreated by applying 5-FU and radiotherapy to all of these patients. So in most countries, also in Europe as in the US, the neoadjuvant 5-FU-based chemorad is standard of care, of course. But the clinical trials are trying to focus on in which patient we could only use chemotherapy as a novel approach, and in others where we could use no perioperative treatment or no preoperative treatment at least at all.
And what specifically, clinically, right now, how do you approach the decision about whether or not to just send the patient right to surgery?
No, actually, we are discussing all patients in the multidisciplinary board with a radiologist who's maybe the most important person in this decision-making setting. And once we have a patient with a mid-third, quite two-stage tumor, we might also consider only giving chemotherapy post-operatively. And in trials, we try to give chemotherapy pre-operatively in this setting.
Without radiation?
Without radiotherapy.
And these are patients who also have ultrasound showing no nodes?
No nodes in ultrasound, of course, but MRI is, I think, the standard of care also for nodes.
Is it acceptable to do MRI without ultrasound?
It is. It clearly is. So ultrasound contributes once you don't have an MRI of excellence, let's say like this, or only CAT scanning of the pelvis, then ultrasound adds information. But if a good phase array MRI, this should be enough for decision making.
And again, in terms of choice of fluoropyrimidine, if you're going to use chemoradiation, 5-FU versus capecitabine?
Well, it's more or less the same like in the adjuvant situation. We have this trial coming from a country where we had the prospective comparison, 5-FU versus capecitabine, and quite convincing data with capecitabine. This was the trial from the German group using 5-FU or capecitabine or 1-by-1 randomization. But also NSABP trial will add to this, right?
So is it a coin flip, or do you prefer one versus the other?
Well, actually, we prefer capecitabine also in terms of convenience for patients.
What about you talked about maybe avoiding radiation. What about avoiding surgery? There was a series just reported in the JCO, people who had clinical CRs where they observed them without surgery.
Absolutely interesting approach in this. So I think, and this is quite interesting, but has to be followed on larger series and maybe also prospectively. But this is really an interesting approach in these patients.
Have you ever done it?
In two patients, I remember, and none of them has relapsed so far. So it's...
These were people who came in not wanting surgery or they saw they had a CR?
Well, no, it was both patients were borderline candidates for surgery. One actively refused further surgery by giving him this information that there might be a chance that he might be cured like this. The other patient deteriorated throughout radiotherapy, so was no candidate after chemorad.
Let's talk a little bit about systemic therapy of advanced disease, and maybe we can begin a little bit with the issue of KRAS testing, and specifically where we are right now in terms of this issue of the, I guess, codon 13 KRAS mutation, and whether actually these patients might benefit from an EGFR antibody. Can you kind of review that topic and talk about your approach?
No, that's an excellent question. So KRAS testing, of course, is a standard of care for decision-making in first-line treatment. We have to keep in mind that KRAS mutant status is a negative predictive marker for not using EGF receptor antibody. It's not a positive predictive marker telling that we have to or we should use this drug. So decision-making in first-line treatment is rather on the basis of the clinical situation and what is the need for treatment intensity. FOLFIRI and cetuximab has a higher intensity, a higher response rate. So in patients, we need high response rates. This is the standard of care. In the vast majority of patients in Germany, we use FOLFOX or bevacizumab as an alternative, given the clinical situation that the patient is asymptomatic. The aim of the treatment is to prolong progression-free survival and to prevent the patient from unnecessary toxicity. So the first decision-making is rather on the basis of clinical decision-making for treatment aim than on the molecular basis. If we look on the molecular basis and see the different mutations, there are some data with cetuximab from a combined analysis of the CRYSTAL and the OPUS trial saying that patients with a distinct subtype of mutation, G13D mutation, might also benefit from the treatment of an EGF receptor antibody, which is quite in contrast to all the other mutations. But on the other hand, this is retrospective data. It's an unpre-planned analysis, so I would be quite cautious. And the only situation where I see a chance of using this is once a patient has undergone treatment with all drugs available, is now clearly progressive, is in without further option, and then showing a G13D mutation, I would consider this patient to be a candidate for an attempt with EGF receptor antibody.
I mean, it seems like people who are labeled as having KRAS mutant tumor kind of run out of options pretty early, it seems like. So you would think it would not be uncommon. I mean, you can obviously hopefully find a trial, but to find somebody who's going through FOLFOX Bev, and I mean, how many options are there beyond that?
Absolutely. So after FOLFIRI, it's done. So FOLFIRI. These are those patients we consider for having a trial with them.
Sort of related to that, can you talk a little bit about what we know about the issue of hepatic-only metastases and the issue of pre-op versus just post-op therapy, and in the patient with a KRAS wild tumor, the selection of specific therapy?
Well, I think the major discriminator is patients either being clearly resectable or patients being not clearly resectable, although this resectability criteria is quite difficult. So patients being clearly resectable, I think the discussion is on whether they should get pre- or post-operative treatment or whether they should get no systemic treatment at all. There are many countries in Europe where only resection is considered a standard of care. So in some European countries, preoperative chemotherapy is quite popular in this, like in France and some parts of Italy. And I think the data of the ERTC trial, which are about to be updated as the upcoming ASCO meeting for the final overall survival analyses, has given some hint that this might work, although the data are not quite convincing.
Could you just again review, because there's so few trials that look at this, and that seems to be the major one people point to. It's been out there for a while. But what exactly the design was?
Well, it was perioperative treatment with FOLFOX, given 3 months pre- and post-operatively, randomized versus surgery alone. And the result was, after a follow-up of 5.2 years, the three-year disease-free survival was 8 to 9% higher in the patient group being treated with FOLFOX.
So I never quite got why that sort of translated into pre-op therapy, because you had the post-op therapy too as a variable.
Right. But given the dose density of the post-op treatment, of course, the higher dose density or treatment intensity was in the pre-op setting. So post-operatively, I think it was only like 70% of the dose density. So you're absolutely right. I'm not sure whether this is the pre or the post, but likely the pre made the difference.
And I guess I know that's being looked at in a U.S. trial. I don't know if there are other trials comparing pre-op to just post-op.
Right. These trials are on the way. We have some in Europe. I learned today that the U.S. trial is about to close, which is prospectively randomizing this C11 as ABP-C11. Is
like, it's accrued?
Yeah.
Really?
No. They failed.
They
gave up.
They gave up?
Yeah.
Wow, because they couldn't get accrual.
Right. That's what I learned today.
Oh, man. That is disappointing. I did not know that.
Right.
How many people had they accrued?
Like 80.
Wow. This is Mike Chody's study?
Right, yeah.
So they could not accrue. Yeah. What a disappointment. So maybe we're not going to get an answer to this definitively.
Right.
So what about biologics in the neoadjuvant setting?
Well, I think it's interesting because I see a need that we have to improve this treatment. The patient with clearly resectable metastases, of course, are our best prognostic group of all metastatic patients. But if you look in 5-year survival, it's 30 to 35%. This is really not good, although it's not bad, but it's not good. So there is some room for improvement. Combination chemotherapy could be an improvement, but also the addition of molecular agents could also be. I think it's uncritical in the preoperative setting because we use these drugs in metastatic disease. We know how they work. So we can see tumor shrink, et cetera, et cetera. So this works, I think, nicely and could be also interesting in trials. On the other hand, most patients are not with resectable metastases being treated preoperatively, but adjuvant. And for adjuvant treatment, we do not know whether these drugs really work. After the disappointments in stage 3, one might be skeptic,
With bevacizumab,
also with cetuximab.
Right, cetuximab too.
Right.
So for practical purposes outside a trial setting right now, first of all, if you have a patient who has resectable disease, do you generally use pre-op therapy?
Well, in most patients, I use pre-op treatment. I think exceptions are patients with one or two very small on the segmental era lying single liver mets. I think if they have good access from surgery, then I would proceed with surgery first. In all others, having two or more metastases and some large metastases, some which might cause some difficulties or might even limit surgery once they shrink, I would consider pre-op treatment.
And which pre-op treatment and what about a biologic? Again, off study.
Well, most patients are in this setting treated with FOLFOX with either bevacizumab or FOLFOX alone.
How do you determine which one?
Depends on the size. So we try to avoid unnecessary toxicity in this setting. And if the patient is clearly resectable, we limit it to chemotherapy.
And in a patient who has borderline resectability, where you're trying to, quote, convert them,
right,
what do you tend to utilize?
Well, if these patients are KRAS wild types, I think they're ideal candidates for EGF receptor-based treatment. So either FOLFOX, panitumumab, or FOLFIRI, cetuximab.
Of course, I don't think have a head-to-head comparison of chemo-bev versus chemo-panitumumab Do you feel, based on comparing it indirectly, that the response rate's greater? Is that why you do it?
I think this is clearly the reason. I think the response rates on the cross-trial comparison are greater, and also the extent of tumor shrinkage is greater with EGF receptor antibodies. So if really tumor shrinkage is the aim, I think this is the best regimen. There's an interesting trial from the ERTC group about to start in 2 weeks, which is head-to-head comparing FOLFOX versus FOLFOX bevacizumab versus FOLFOX panitumumab given pre- and postoperatively in resectable liver metastases. And from this trial, we will learn about the biologic activity of these drugs or of these combinations to the liver mets and to the healthy liver tissue.
And of course, this must be KRAS wild tumor.
This is KRAS wild type limited only, right?
Let's talk a little bit about new agents that are out there. We're starting to hear about a whole bunch of them. One that you've been involved with is the VEGF trap agent of aflibercept.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about how the drug works and in comparison to other anti-angiogenics and what we know about it?
Right. So regarding the mechanism of action, it's some in-between of a monoclonal antibody and a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It is not attacking the VEGF receptor, it's binding free VEGF. So in this kind, it works more or less like bevacizumab, which is also binding VEGF-A. Aflibercept has a quite broader spectrum of activity. It's binding VEGF-A, VEGF-B, and PLGF. And these three factors are all three together very important for angiogenesis. So the mechanism of action is less selective than with bevacizumab on a broader spectrum of activity.
It's a fused protein, correct?
It's a much smaller protein than a monoclonal antibody using some shedded parts of a VEGF-1, VEGF-2 receptor, and they are combined on the basis of biotechnics to this fusion protein.
And what clinical research data we have on this agent right now? Of course, there's the big phase 3 trial, the VALOR study that you were involved with.
Right. So far in colorectal cancer, the most experience we have from this phase 3 VALOR trial, which was a second-line trial after failure of FOLFOX, and patients were randomized to either FOLFIRI placebo versus FOLFIRI aflibercept. Primary endpoint was overall survival, and the overall survival improved by about 20%.
And anything else you want to say in terms of the efficacy data, response rates? Or
so response rate nearly doubled, 11% with the FOLFIRI, about 20% with a combination. And also PFS, of course, was improved by the addition of aflibercept.
What about side effects and toxicity?
There are more side effects than with bevacizumab. And this is something we have to keep an eye on. Rate of grade 3-4 diarrhea rose to about 20% compared to 10% in the chemo arm only. And another adverse event we have been observing in this trial is asthenia, which is really affecting patients' quality of life. And this has to be, I think, prospectively looked at.
Where are things heading with this agent in colorectal cancer?
Well, we need more data. Of course, we need first-line data. We need data with oxaliplatin and a randomized phase 2 trial with oxaliplatin plus minus aflibercept is going to be reported at the ASCO meeting. We need data for the setting of liver metastases. We need to learn what it does to the healthy liver, what it does to the metastases, whether we can get a pathophysiological response by the addition of a drug like this. So these data will help us to understand better.
What about VEGF-like side effects that are seen with bevacizumab, hypertension, proteinuria, for example?
Well, interestingly, hypertension rates with aflibercept are somehow higher than with bevacizumab. So in this VALOR trial, the grade 3-4 rate of hypertension was 19%. So this is higher than with bevacizumab.
What about proteinuria?
Which was not a major problem in this, so only very few patients developed.
If the drug were available right now, would you utilize it and in what situations?
Well, it could be utilized in second-line treatment after failing FOLFOX. The question is, what is about after failure of FOLFOX and bevacizumab? Because this drug has been looked at in these randomized trials, and in this trial, patients had undergone pretreatment with either FOLFOX or FOLFOX bevacizumab. And interestingly, only data are available from the subgroup of about 30% of these patients with pretreatment with FOLFOX bevacizumab. But interestingly, there was also some activity in these pretreated patients. So this might be an interesting option, I think, especially for patients with KRAS mutations, because they don't have other options. So if you have a KRAS mutant patient failing FOLFOX bevacizumab, I think it would be highly interesting to treat him with FOLFIRI, aflibercept.
Of course, another issue that's being looked at out of Europe and Germany is the question of continuation of bevacizumab on progression. Can you talk about that trial that you've been involved with? And are there any situations outside a trial setting, if you can get the drug paid for, where you would continue bevacizumab on progression? Where I hear people raising the issue is a patient who's had a very good response to chemo bevacizumab and then slowly progresses.
Absolutely. So this is a clinical situation where I could consider that continuation of bevacizumab could make sense. And we have this supportive data from the phase 4 trials distributed by the ARIES or BRIGHT Observatory trial, which has shown that the difference between patients continuing it on another chemotherapy or another chemotherapy plus bevacizumab favored the combination. But we will have this data from this randomized trials quite soon at the ASCO meeting, hopefully. So then we'll definitely see what it means.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about regorafenib that's being presented here at this meeting. What is it? And at least from the abstract, what do we know about it?
Well, regorafenib is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, inhibiting two VEGF receptors. The design of this trial, which will be presented at this meeting here, is a randomized comparison of regorafenib versus no treatment in completely refractory patients. And this has shown a surprising high activity in these patients with an increment or improvement in overall survival of these patients by more than 20%. So this shows there is activity as single agent, but we have to know and have to evaluate what this really means in the clinical practice and in earlier treatment lines, of course.
Now, when you say 20%, you know, that's, I guess, a relative improvement because the actual, these are people right. who had advanced disease, right. lots of treatment. Right. So the actual benefit was tiny, you know, absolutely.
Absolutely. So I think for a quite active drug, this is not the ideal role to be placed in last line.
Do you see the drug becoming available based on these data, or do you think more research is going to be needed?
Well, I'm not sure about whether this really will convince FDA or EMA. So the clinical need is clearly given in this last line. We have nothing else to offer to the patients, so this adds. But on the other way, the absolute increment, as said by you, is relatively small, so I'm not really sure.
What about the downside of the drug? What kind of side effects are seen?
Well, it's class-specific. It's hypertension mostly, and it's some asthenia, and it's some liver toxicity. And this has to be kept in mind or has to be monitored carefully in the development of this drug, which is now combined in earlier lines with standard chemotherapy. So, for example, in a phase 3 trial with FOLFOX in first line.
What other new agents are out there that you heard about that you think, you know, have some potential to move forward?
That's an interesting question. So I think the c-MET inhibitors might play a role, and also some specific BRAF inhibitors, which are under investigation, like murafenib, which specifically attack BRAF-mutated tumors, will be interesting.
What about the antibody ramucirumab? That's an anti-angiogenic antibody, but it seems to have a different sort of mechanism.
Right. It's an antibody targeting not the ligand, but targeting the VEGF receptor. So it's a classic receptor antibody, another different mechanism of action. And we'll have to see the data. There will be some data very soon available in gastric cancer, and this will help us to understand or maybe to estimate what will be the role in metastatic colorectal.
I want to ask you about another common clinical situation, which is the patient who presents with a primary, either a colon or rectal cancer, but also metastatic disease, might be resectable liver mets, or might just be metastatic disease. And then there's the variable of symptomatic versus asymptomatic. Can you talk a little bit about how you approach these patients who present with a primary and metastatic disease?
That's always a difficult situation where you can't do something which is the standard, how it has to be. I always say, well, one thing which is clearly not the thing which has to be done is patients having synchronous metastases and rectal cancer. And in these patients, the classic or standard chemo-rad 5-FU-based is the only thing which is not the best thing to be done. On the other patient, it depends. Is it symptomatic from the primary tumor, from the metastases, and what is the treatment aim? Of course, all these patients are metastatic, so meaning their prognosis is to be seen like a metastatic patient rather than like a locally advanced rectal cancer. So this always limits the decision making. So keep in mind, these patients have a poor overall survival once the systemic disease is not controlled, whatever will be done with the primary tumor. And from my feeling, in these situations, too much effort is put on the local situation generally.
So what, for example, in a patient who has rectal cancer and, you know, non-resectable disease, you know, lung, liver mets, what typically might be your initial approach?
I would start with a systemic treatment, like with FOLFOX, bevacizumab, would assess the response carefully. And once we have a responding patient and we have the disease, the systemic disease under control, we can consider local treatment for the rectal mass whenever this is in need or not. But it would never be an option to start with the treatment of the primary tumor first.
What would prompt you to use, and when you say local treatment, you mean chemo radiation or just radiation?
This means chemo radiation anyway. When we can apply chemo radiation, we should use chemo radiation in this.
What would prompt you to do that?
Well, if we have a relatively large tumor mass and we have a quite certain likelihood, my patient run into difficulties at a time point when we lose control of the systemic situation, then we'll likely also have a growing local tumor, and this can, of course, cause difficulties.
Have you had patients like that who you've been able to manage until death or metastatic disease who never had local therapy?
Of course we had, yeah. Now, systemic treatment, quite surprisingly, is very active in the local situation. It's more active in the local tumor than in many different metastatic sites. This has to be kept in mind. We know that these tumors really shrink and respond quite well to systemic treatment.
Now, what about colon cancer presenting, again, with unresectable metastatic disease? Assuming the patient is asymptomatic, you'll just go right into a systemic algorithm?
Well, actually, I would like to do this. In Germany, we have a tradition of obsessively operating on these patients with the primary tumor. But I know that many countries, also UK, to learn from the colleagues, about 15% of these patients live with their tumors in situ, with only a minority of these patients really running into difficulties with this. So maybe it's an approach to consider these patients to leave the primary tumor in situ.
And again, with the likelihood or hope that you're going to be able to manage them until their death or metastatic disease without having to have surgery.
Right.
I'm curious, just sort of taking a step back, what your prediction is for how we're going to be managing colorectal cancer 3 to 5 years from now.
I think we'll still have the issue, what defines treatment intensity? Is it clinical situation or is it molecular situation? And this will still be question number one. And question number two will be, depending on the molecular pattern, which drug should be given. But I personally don't think that we will have the whole decision making only on the basis of molecular information. As you can see in many charts of many presentations where you have this I-spy-like type of design, personally, I think it will still be relevant to have treatment aim and considering what we have as a situation in the patient's pattern of metastases, which will drive the treatment.
Anything that we haven't talked about today, particularly in terms of colorectal cancer, that, you know, maybe we ought to?
Well, actually, my personal interest in this also contributes to the way we'll treat patients in 3 to 4 years. We have to put some emphasis, I think, also on local ablative strategies, because we have learned from the biology of colon cancer that once we control the metastases by systemic treatment and by ablating them, for a subset of patients, we can prevent them from continuing on chemotherapy for a long time, although they might still be in a palliative setting. So I think there has to put some effort in integration of local ablative techniques like radiofrequency ablation, SIRT, all of these fusional things, and also the combination of either methods.